Stop. Talk to me.
Hello, my name is Grant Oliphant, and I'm privileged to serve as CEO of the Conrad Prebys Foundation here in San Diego. And we are about to embark upon a great program. Joining me here is my co-host for the program and colleague at the foundation, Crystal Page. Crystal, it's so nice to be here with you.
Thank you so much, Grant. It's an honor to get to join you on air. It's been fun to be behind the scenes, and you just do such good work, and I'm inspired to inspire other people to do the same.
Well, and right back at you. And the reason we wanted to do this together is it's kind of more fun to talk about the people that we're interviewing with someone and have the opportunity to reflect on, okay, what are we going to talk about? And then what did we just hear? Because one person's impressions are great, but there's a lot more that comes out in the dialogue. And you are the perfect person to do that with. So I'm really pleased to be able to have this conversation with you. Today we're talking with Mike Parzon, who is the head of the Museum of Us here in San Diego. Mike is really an interesting guy, a nonprofit leader, of course, but before that he was an attorney. He was an anthropologist. He cares about what the museum has done. He led it through a very difficult and contentious name change some years ago, where he took it from the Museum of Man to the Museum of Us. And, you know, changing the names of things is a contentious issue in our society. But he really did a nice job. And in this conversation, I think we're going to have a terrific dialogue about what it is to lead that museum, but also what it is to do the deeper work of changing how San Diego relates to its history and its culture and the infinite possibility that exists here.
Yeah, I think, Michael was your idea to bring into studio. And I remember coming back to San Diego and hearing about this Museum of Us. And I was like, oh, I haven't been to that one. Mm. Turned out it was formerly known as the Museum of Man, which I'd gone to dozens of times as a kid. And I guess I'm just really excited. You have to be a pretty brave person to say, hey, you know what? I need to get together with community and we need to rethink these things. So excellent choice on your part. But I'm also just really curious to see what his journey's been, what the feedback has been.
Yeah. And part of what we're going to be talking about is a manifestation of what you just described, which is the work that the museum did in partnership with the Friends of Friendship Park to preserve panels from the Friendship Park border wall that was being disassembled as part of the replacement of the border wall project that has been going on. We'll talk more about that after we give him a chance to discuss it with us here on air. But I think it is a beautiful way of understanding how one of the ways in which the border is part of our culture and our identity in this region.
You know, I think working at Prebys Foundation has afforded us the chance to think about these multiple cultures, right? Mm-hmm. We've got the Kumeyaay, we have the border with Mexico, and we have San Diego. So I think I'm curious to see how you take us through the thoughts on that in your interview with Micah, and I look forward to talking about it afterwards.
Well, why don't we dive in, have a listen to the conversation with Micah, and then we'll come back and figure it all out. I just want to start by thanking you, Micah, for being here today and joining me for this conversation.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
I've wanted to talk to you for a while because I view you as that rare leader who is both a visionary about what he wants to create in the world through the organization that he's leading, and also courageous in the pursuit of it and willing to shake things up. And I say that specifically to embarrass you. So I want to get it out of the way. And but I think it's important in framing this conversation Just the name of the institution that you had, the Museum of Us, was not the name when you arrived there. And before we dive into anything else, I just want to have you tell a little bit of the story about why the Museum of Man in San Diego became the Museum of Us.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. And it was a long journey that really started well before my time in the early 1990s when folks started to take issue with the lack of inclusiveness of the name. And we took the subject matter back up in 2017, and we had just evolved so much as an institution. Our values had changed, the kind of work we were doing had changed, and the world around us had changed so much as well. And it just didn't feel like we were a San Diego Museum of Man anymore. And we went through this long process to sort of vet possible names and test them with the public. And the public kind of freaked out and said, what do you mean? You can't change the name of the iconic, nostalgic Museum of Man. But when COVID hit and the murder of George Floyd upon murder and the sort of social justice turn that many museums started to take, we decided that now was the time. And early on in the pandemic, I had read a article in the Financial Times by Arundhati Roy called The Pandemic is a Portal. And
I remember that article.
It's phenomenal. She really sort of makes that case that we have an extraordinary opportunity in the midst of this suffering and pain to emerge as a better version of ourselves. And we really took that call to heart, and we decided to go for it. And we really wanted a name that was part descriptive of the journey we had been on into developing better and better practices and what an anti-racist museum could look like, what a decolonial museum could look like. And we also wanted a name that was part aspirational, one that really forced us to constantly ask that question, what does it really mean to be a museum that is truly for all of us and not just for the usual suspects? And that was about 3.5 years ago, and it was one of the best things we ever did.
Well, and you know from the research you did that people don't love change necessarily, even if they get intellectually why you might want to change the name. I think people who grow up with something like to remember it the way it was and have an affinity for how things are talked about. What was it that you learned from that research that you carried with you into the process of changing the name anyway?
I think that, you know, there's no recipe for success or name that everybody's going to love, but a true recipe for failure is to try to make everybody happy all the time.
Right.
You know, you're just not going to do it. So we really brought out of that process the importance of being very clear about who you are and what you stand for as an organization. And when you do that, I think it really gives people something to react to. Either it will resonate deeply with them, they will be curious about it, or it will touch a nerve in them and really trigger things. And, you know, I think that's really a valuable add to community discussions, because people began to think, what do I stand for? And shouldn't all of our arts and culture institutions be helping people figure that out as we navigate this extremely complicated, multifaceted world we live in?
I think the name that you came up with, the Museum of Us, is a powerful one, and it captures the desire to be broadly inclusive and to make sure that everyone is represented in the museum. Who did you feel was not being represented in the museum before?
Yeah, well, you know, that name, San Diego Museum of Man, was very old school. Really,
it was based on anthropology,
right?
I mean, that was the idea of mankind, and
that's right. Yeah. And very much a sort of Western scholarly academic gaze. You know, this idea that, well, we won the colonial endeavor, and to the victor go the spoils. And so we get to take all your stuff and become experts about all the stuff. Mm-hmm. And also now we're experts about you. And really a sort of boxing out and a trampling on the voices and the lived experience of the folks who went through those events on the other side, right? So the name was really designed to sort of you know, break that open, flip the script, and imagine again what could a museum look like? Is it if it's really for all of us and not just for some of us?
So how do you begin to tell that broader story? When you thought about, okay, we've got a name and we've kind of got a sense for what this museum could look like. Mm. What was the story you wanted to begin to tell?
You know, I think it was really one of humility to start with, Grant. Mm. Really starting with the acknowledgement and recognition and beginning to tell the truth about a very messy and difficult history of harms that were promulgated by the museum against Indigenous peoples in particular and other communities of color. And, you know, beginning to build trust and relationship anew with these folks that we had harmed. And that took a lot of time to really overcome the skepticism. You know, we also learned that you can't all of a sudden come to somebody who you've harmed for a very long time and say, you know, we're different now. Let's be best friends. We're good, right? Yeah. You really have to, you know, show up and do what you say you're going to do and even take some hits in order to continue to hold space to develop a different kind of relationship.
And were you surprised by the type of blowback that you got when you made this move?
I don't think so. I think we, you know, until you're in the blowback, you can theoretically identify.
What did you hear from people? How did people react when you made this move?
You know, I wouldn't say I had death threats, but there were
people
some.
People are very attached to their museum.
Absolutely. You know, we had a lot of philanthropists actually who had supported the museum from this more nostalgic Museum of Man lens that were quite unhappy and, you know, definitely made an effort to make sure I knew that their support would be withheld if we continued down that path. And then, in fact, when we announced the new name, you know, they withdrew their support. And at the same time, we also had this outpouring of love and support and a booing by the community to really lead to a doubling down of support of many of our existing donors and also a whole new kind of cadre of folks who came on explicitly because we had had the courage to change the name and move forward in a different direction.
So when I was pressing you earlier on whose story wasn't getting told, you know, I think what comes up is obviously the story of women doesn't feel like it's being captured by the old name and approach. The Kumeyaay population here was not represented. And there were deep feelings about on the part of Indigenous folks about the history, not just of the museum, but of Balboa Park. Can you say a little bit about that, too?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. A lot of people don't know this, but first off, Balboa never set foot in Balboa Park. It was really a sort of commercial advertising ploy to come up with a name that was familiar to folks that could put San Diego on the map as the first port of entry after the opening of the Panama Canal. Even more significantly, however, and something that most people don't know, is that there were, in fact, Kumeyaay peoples living in Balboa Park at the time of the planning of the 1915 Panama California Exposition. And the organizers, the architects, the urban planners of the exposition, who met in the building of the Museum of Us, our administrative building, those folks deemed the Kumeyaay living in the park to be insufficiently Indian from a stereotypical perspective. And so they forcibly removed them from their homes. And then they went to Arizona and they brought in Pueblo Indians who sort of looked the part from a traditional perspective. And they set up an Indian demonstration village called the Painted Desert over on the other side of the park, where these Pueblo Indians did dancing and weaving and basketry and pottery demonstrations for all the tourists to gawk at. And so this is really the colonial harm and sort of racist harm that the whole park emerges out of.
You have shared this story with me before, and of course I know it's part of the history of the park, but it still stupefies me when I hear the story that the actual Indigenous population that was living in the park and on that ground was removed so as to have somebody who looked more the part that they actually were could take their place and make the case to tourists. So when we talk about harm, that's, you know, that's significant, and that's what you're pointing to. I think it's important to acknowledge Balboa Park is an extraordinary community asset. You know, if you fast forward to today, you would be hard pressed to find both a park and a concentration of cultural facilities like we have in Balboa Park today, anywhere else in the country. It's a unique kind of cultural asset, but it doesn't mean that there aren't these stories attached with it that we still have to work through. When you made this move with the Museum of Us, how did you start doing outreach to the populations who had been hurt by either that history specifically or just the way in which it was talked about?
Yeah. You know, initially when we started down this path, this isn't where we realized we would end up. You know, we just felt the museum needed a real change. It needed to become more relevant. And we started to bring in stakeholders to sort of ask, what does that look like? A key moment for us was when we brought the Race, Are We So Different exhibit to the museum back in 2011 for 3 months. We eventually purchased it in 2015. And it's an exhibit about race and racism. And, you know, we learned you can't bring an exhibit like that without really looking under the hood of your own privilege and the ways in which you're positioned in a community, the ways in which you have harmed other communities whose voices have traditionally not been part of the normative narrative. And it forced us to really look under the hood and sort of unpack that privilege in a way that kept leading to the Kumeyaay community and to other indigenous communities whose belongings we had taken for them and whose ancestors we had taken from them and refused to give back for decades. And, you know, we really began this process by reaching out to them and saying, we want to do better. You know, we know better now, as Maya Angelou says, right? Yeah. When you know better, you do better. And, you know, they really didn't believe us at first. You know, they said, why would we believe you? You know, you've treated us so poorly all this time. And we said, no, we really mean it. And would you have the grace and the patience to sort of work with us to do better? And really fortunately, they exhibit extraordinary grace and patience with us after all this harm that our institution and others like ours have done. They really were willing to sort of help us find that path. And I think a lot of deep listening to the community, right? And really understanding after we've built up enough trust and relationship that they would honestly tell us what their pain points are. And then working with them to develop human-centered, community-centered solutions to begin to address those pain points. And I think that has often led us to make very different types of decisions where we are privileging what their preferences are and how they would like us to act, often in ways that feel detrimental to, you know, the running of a business or a nonprofit. But ultimately, in terms of playing the long game, it's paying off.
Can you give an example of that?
Yeah. You know, before we sort of took this decolonial turn, we would often get overtures from private exhibit companies. And one in particular had an exhibit that was traveling all around the world in major venues called Mummies of the World. And they came to us early on and we thought, wow, we have a chance to really generate some revenues here. And we sure need them, right? You know, always trying to make budgets work. And, you know, we did that almost without a second thought. But years later, as we learn more from our indigenous partners and the role that, of course, ancestors play in their communities, we realized we were sort of pimping out our mummies, as we called them at the time, for our own financial games. So not only had we harmed them by taking these ancestors, but then we continued to harm them. Mm-hmm. So we stopped practices like that, and it meant an impact to our bottom line. And sometimes that took the form of earned revenues, as in this case, but often it took the form of philanthropic contributory revenues when maybe a particular donor started to evidence very different values from the types of values we had as an institution. And we ultimately had to become comfortable with blessing and releasing those folks and turning to the people who did have values consistent with who we are and what we stand for.
It's a great example. You know, I heard a poets say once that there are no evil places, only holy places and desecrated places. Mm-hmm. And I think what you're describing is a moment where you had to think through whether this financially lucrative act would in fact desecrate who you want to be and how you serve the community. You know, if we fast forward to today, I have to ask this question because the values you're espousing are caught in a cultural cross current anew right now. It's not as though they weren't 4 years ago when you started down this path, but now we're seeing the inevitable pendulum swing around conversations on redressing past harms, how we define us. You know, the people have complicated feelings all across the spectrum about what that means and who's saying it. And I'm curious, are you feeling at all the impact of these cultural cross currents that we're seeing in society today as this conversation continues to evolve? And I'm trying to keep this away from politics because I think there is something deeper here about how people think about these issues. And I'm just curious, because you're always so thoughtful about it and not reacting to the immediate gusts and winds of change. How are you processing what you're seeing right now?
It's tough. You know, it's a extraordinarily messy and difficult time where I think we're all being asked to take a side in a black and white world where, you know, we really live in many, many shades of gray, mm-hmm. right? You know, it's a world in which either you're with me or against me. Mm-hmm. And I think what we're trying to do in many ways is sort of be transpartisan, mm-hmm. you know, transnational, to rise above these kinds of issues that try to force us to frame the world in that way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've had many conversations about belonging, of course, in the past and, you know, been thinking a lot about issues in that space of, you know, how do we approach belonging? Is it from the perspective of abundance, or is it from the perspective of scarcity? I think belonging is sort of an issue that we all strive for no matter who we are. We all want to walk in a room and feel that we're part of something and that we're accepted and we can bring our whole self into the space. And I think when you're in that space, you can either retreat back and say, I'm going to try to protect my sense of belonging. And if that means pushing others out, I'll do so. Or this feels so good, I want others to experience that as well. And I'm often reminded of the phrase, that which you appreciate, appreciates. You know, that which you really focus on, that you are grateful for, that you really put your energy into, you know, that will grow. And I think that happens time and time again, whereas if you come from a fear-based perspective, you know, there's a retrenchment, right? There's a tightening of the circle. And, you know, so I think the Museum of Us is really about trying to create a sense of possibility that there is abundance out there, that we can all belong, but it requires us wanting that for each other and often doing the hard work necessary to allow that to happen.
I'm so glad I asked you that question, because I think the way in which you captured the idea of belonging and how it really does include everyone and how we can embrace that while setting aside these other, you know, sort of wildly passionate feelings that we see in the political realm. Basically, what it boils down to is we live in a community. We want that community to include everyone who's here and the history of everyone who's here. And isn't that a dignity we would all want for ourselves and for each other? I mean, that's what I hear you saying.
Yes,
is
right on.
Correct. So, As we think about how you take that message out into the world of today, the very complicated world of today, I'm curious, you know, how you are thinking about your continued relevance in this environment. And you used the word relevance a little while ago. What projects are you working on, or things are you working on that are particularly exciting to you now, that for you manifest this desire to tell the story of San Diego, tell the story of everyone who's here, and bring alive the spirit that you're describing so well?
Well, I think the main project that is taking up most of our bandwidth and time and energy at the museum these days is something we're referring to as the Border Wall Preservation Project. This began where, as you know, the federal government decided that it was going to take down the wall at Friendship Park, which has been a gathering point for decades for people on both sides of the border, and replace it with a 30-foot wall instead of the 18-foot wall that currently exists. And the existing wall has all sorts of beautiful protest art on it and all sorts of meaningful stories connected throughout. For example, you know, somebody dying of a terminal illness who's able to connect with a loved one for the last time, even though their loved one had been deported, or a grandparent who got to see a granddaughter, a grandson for the first time on one side of the border or another. All these amazing stories and moments that are contained in this place of great deep connection and also place of deep pain and sorrow, right? Well, the Friends of Friendship Park, who has been advocating for this space for decades now as a site of connection and remembrance and transcendence, reached out to us and said, look, we've sort of lost the battle to save the wall from being torn down and replaced, and it's going to be torn down. Would you consider reaching out to see if you might be able to preserve it? And we jumped at the opportunity and said, absolutely. We reached out to Customs and Border Protection. We thought they would never say yes. And initially, they sort of raked me over the coals in terms of what would you do with these sections of the wall? You know, who would decide? What would be your process? They sort of passed me on to somebody else who eventually told me that once the wall gets taken down, it becomes the property of the contractor. And if the contractor was interested in giving them to the museum, they could do so, and that they had reached out to the contractor and they were willing to do so. It was just a matter of logistics. So over the past several months, we have been going to the border, entering into the sort of no man's land and picking up these enormous sections of the wall. They are 18 feet tall. They're 8 feet wide. They're about 4,300 pounds apiece. We've identified 21 that Friends of Friendship Park would like us to procure. We've got 14 of them safe and sound in our storage facility so far, with the remaining seven scheduled for pickup within the next few weeks. So this is a project that we hope to be behind the scenes on, in the sense of the museum helped make this happen, yes, but what we're really going to do is redistribute this wealth. You know, one government's trash is another trinational community's wealth. Redistribute it, this treasure, back into the trinational community on both sides of the border, including the Kumeyaay Nation. And we hope to ultimately create a constellation of interpretive sites. So think the Stewart Collection in UCSD writ large over, you know, hundreds of miles in our trinational region to share the stories of
Friendship Park. Art, in essence, spread throughout communities around the San Diego region.
Exactly.
So this project will have gone live by the time, or at least you will have announced it by the time this podcast airs. And it's extraordinary. I mean, it's a phenomenal public art concept. I can imagine that the federal government representatives who you reached out to had to think twice when they heard from a guy named Mike Parzon who wanted a bunch of these panels.
Yes.
I mean, and you clearly made the case well. Why, you know, for people who wonder. The border wall right now is just, it's a political artifact, you know, in terms of how it's talked about. And there are these incredible passions on both sides of the issue and both sides of the border about what the wall itself represents. Why is it also a cultural artifact? Mm. Why is it important to tell that story? And I get that there's art on both sides of it, which is wonderful, and you captured that. But why is it a cultural artifact beyond that?
Well, I think as a starting point, you know, we know we're on the unceded ancestral homeland of the Kumeyaay Nation, right, mm-hmm. who have stewarded this land since time immemorial. And Those folks used to, you know, roam freely and trade freely and subsist freely in this region, right? The sea, the mountains, the desert, they emerged out of this land and this soil. And, you know, at some point, you know, following the war between Mexico and the United States, there was a decision through the Treaty of the Guadalupe Hidalgo to indicate that this was the border. And it was a random act in many ways that created an arbitrary line that created a future that ensued that was very different than what had preceded. Mm-hmm. So I think when we start even with the Kumeyaay story and who the Kumeyaay are and whose land this actually was from a stewardship perspective. And then, you know, of course, the increasing militarization of the border over many years when First Lady Pat Nixon in, I think, 1971 designated Friendship Park, you know, there was a barbed wire fence and people moved freely. When I was a young person growing up in San Diego, we would regularly go down to Mexico for an evening, at lunch, and a night. You weren't waiting hours and hours. And over time, as that border has been built up and militarized, families have been separated from one another. There has been a profound disconnection among millions and millions of people, right? And so this site begins to emerge as a place where we transcend those politics, right? We begin to find ways that we can deeply tap into our humanity and what's really important to us as individuals, as families, as communities, and ultimately as a society.
It's one of the things about San Diego that I think is distinctive, that the border is a living, breathing part of the identity of this community, for good and bad, for challenges and beautiful gifts. It's just part of who we are. And I think it took an act of inspiration for someone to think of preserving pieces of this old Friendship Park border wall to capture some of that narrative. So thank you for that. I just think that's extraordinary.
Thank you, Grant.
You're also, you know, you mentioned belonging, and you mentioned the trinational region, which is a term that just I started using almost automatically when I came here, because I saw this convergence not only of two nations but also of the Kumeyaay peoples, and the fact that we have all of that here is again such an extraordinary part of our culture. But you have really tried to convey belonging across all three. And now you're working on a project to actually make that a physical part of the Museum of Us. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, definitely. And thank you, as a philanthropic leader in our community and beyond, for recognizing the importance of language, right? We know how much language matters. And every time we say binational, it's an act of inadvertent, often, erasure of the Kumeyaay Nation. And what we're trying to do is create something that really honors that at its essence, and that is to create a center for trinational belonging, which would be at the western gateway of the park in our administrative building. I told this story earlier about the Kumeyaay being dispossessed of their land back in 1915, and that happened in our very building, right? And the entire park, as you know, is really a celebration, a glorification of colonialism, and a sweeping under the rug of the atrocities and the harms to indigenous peoples and other communities of color that occurred as a result. So what we want to do through this center is to create a place at that western gateway of the park where everybody feels like they belong, a place where people can process our constellation of social justice exhibits through a sort of lens of what, so what, and now what. The what being the experience of the exhibits themselves, whether it's race or immigration or Friendship Park. The so what being, what does it mean for me, my community, my team, my organization, my society? And the now what being, how do I translate this into meaningful action? So the idea of the center is that it begins to really uplift and center the voices and lived experience of those who haven't been part of the dominant narrative. And we think in doing so, by creating a space for workshops and retreats and field trips and an indigenous consultation room and a place where the Kumeyaay on both sides of the border can call home, that we'll begin to shift the energy, not just of the museum, but of the entire Balboa Park, that instead of being a celebration and a glorification of colonialism from the get-go, there's a problematization and an asking of questions and a challenging of assumptions that can lead to a larger building of critical mass and ultimately a different world 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the road.
You also play a leading role on the board of the Balboa Park Cultural Partnership, and you're the board chair.
That's right.
And that organization does excellent work, by the way, in advocating for the arts in San Diego and for advocating for Balboa Park. Balboa Park is economically a huge asset for San Diego. I think far beyond the credit it's given in terms of the tourists that it attracts here, the visitors who come here from all over the region, the jobs that it generates and the economic activity it generates. And yet it is in the midst of this changing psychology about who and what it should be, including the questions you're asking. When you try and square what you're doing at the Museum of Us and what's happening with Balboa Park to keep Balboa Park alive and vital and relevant for a new generation, how does it translate across that boundary? And what are you seeing happen with the park that is important to what you're doing?
I think it really does come down to the word relevance that you mentioned. You know, when we think down the road 10, 20, 30 years from now, it's the new generation coming up, the new generation of park goers and museum goers who we're really trying to speak to now so that Balboa Park, the Museum of Us, is a place and a set of places that people want to go. And if you look at younger people today, you know, the binaries and dichotomies that you and I may have grown up with, whether it's gender or black, white or sexual orientation, you know, they just don't exist anymore. There's a fluidity among younger folks coming up, and also an expectation that their cultural institutions will play a very different role in their lives. I think it's critically important that whether it's the Museum of Us or Balboa Park, that we're thinking decades down the road along those lines. For younger people, the kind of work we're doing at the Museum of Us is obvious to them. You know, the main reaction I get from younger people is, duh, you know, what took you so long to change your name? And if we're not sort of keeping pace with that sensibility, so it requires some letting go of the older generation, I think, and that's change is hard, as we talked about earlier, to really say, you know, we've had our run and it's been rewarding and wonderful in all sorts of ways, and the world's changed around us. And now we need to begin to bridge to a new way of being in the world and create something for future generations. So I think the work we've been doing at the Museum of Us, I often kind of frame as, you know, when you're at home and you're baking cookies and they smell really good and, you know, your neighbors sort of start to sniff around and say, oh, well, that smells amazing. Like, I want some of that, right? We've just been doing the work internally and that comes out externally in all sorts of ways. And I think people have gotten very curious about it and seeing that we're having a lot of success. And, you know, the world has changed so much that people are starting to catch up. So we want Balboa Park to be ahead of the curve and not reactive. And yet, you know, there's a wide range of stakeholders in the park and everybody has a very different orientation towards what the park should be. And we want to be very careful that we're not appealing to the lowest common denominator, that instead we're being aspirational.
Right. And inspiring people to come regardless of how they feel about the many things that you just said.
That's right.
You know, I think it is probably true that we don't know how some of these social changes that you just described will play out over time. You know, somebody pointed out to me recently that we made assumptions during the 60s and early 70s about how young people would evolve in their tastes and wants. And the reality was both similar and quite different to what anybody foresaw. So I think some of the assumptions we make today about what today's young people believe, we probably should be humble about those too. And I just want to put that on the table because I don't think we actually know. And we're, you know, older generations are quick to condemn. Younger generations are quick to say, we're on the right path. And I think what we'll find out is what we usually find out, which is that the truth is somewhere in the middle.
Yes.
But tell me a little bit about, as we begin to wrap up, why you think that a place like the Museum of Us can be a place of hope and inspiration for what right now feels like a society that's deeply caught up, and you said it, you know, fights over things that seem black and white, and we're divided into camps where you know, often political, but sociological and demographic as well, and where we're caught up, I think, in an era of unique negativity around the fate of the planet. And sometimes, by the way, I think the field that I work in feeds that by, we're very good at problem analysis and not so good at the solution side necessarily. Why is a place like the Museum of Us or a unique cultural center like the Cultural District in Balboa Park important and potentially inspirational as a way out of this thicket that we find ourselves in?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I'm not sure I have the answer, but I'll give it a shot.
Thank you.
I think it goes back to abundance versus scarcity, you know, that we're constantly creating a zero-sum game. And the Museum of Us is about trying to create a world of abundance where everybody can find a place that they belong, you know. And I think the entire sort of premise of museums and the idea that museums hold a great degree of public trust, right? They're among the most trusted public institutions out there. The data are always supporting that. And I think it's a problematic house of cards a little bit, that in many ways, museums emerged in a sort of elitist mentality to serve a certain subset of the population. And as we are maturing and becoming more sophisticated as a larger society, we realize that it's time to come up with a new foundation for trust. That instead of a house of cards, that if you blow on it too hard, it will all come tumbling down, to create a foundation that really centers community voices and lived experience and honors everybody and does so from a perspective of abundance, not from scarcity. You know, that by making space in the dominant mainstream narrative for new voices and new lived experience to really inform the discussion, we all get better in that process. And so it requires that sort of pausing and that moment of humility that I have a story to tell, and that is important, and it is one story. And the more I hear from others and their lived experience and their stories, and the more we make room to center their voices, the better I become too, because I understand the range of what it means to be human. And going back to Maya Angelou, you know, when we know better, we can do better. So I think the museum and other institutions like ours can really be beacons of hope in that way, because we're not reproducing the sort of traditional narrative and structure and trying to find a path. You know, Audre Lorde said the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house, right? So we have to kind of come together to find out, how do we build a new house together using different kinds of tools and creating a different kinds of future.
And I love that. I love that framing. You know, the Prebys Foundation believes in a vision of community well-being, where we think the capacity for belonging that you described is a key component of that. So is the sense that everybody should have the ability to contribute and to find their path in the community. That's opportunity, and they should also have a sense of purpose. They should feel like is a place where they can fulfill whatever destiny it is that they feel they're here to ultimately contribute to the world. That purpose, opportunity, and belonging neatly defines what makes up, I think, strong mental health for any one of us, and community health for a region such as ours. What I want to finish on this question. What do you want people who visit the museum to walk away feeling or believing about San Diego? Mm-hmm. And we have this unique mix of people. We are still, for the time being, the largest group of folks is white, but that's changing quickly. And we have substantial Latino and Asian populations and, of course, a black population of note here in San Diego as well. We've got the Kumeyaay people and other indigenous tribes as well. So we got a mix, and it is constantly evolving. You know, it really does feel like the future of America. And so we get to help answer a question that America will ultimately have to answer. And it would be nice if we could answer it well so that the rest of the country could follow suit. What do you want people in San Diego to believe when they walk away from your museum?
Yeah, I love how you framed the question, because this is such an extraordinarily special place for all the reasons you mentioned, a sort of coming together of people in such a unusual and unique way, with such an unusual and unique history and on a very particular landscape. And yet, it also tells a much larger story. Anthropologists often refer to this idea of the universal in the particular, meaning that, yes, we have a very unique particular story that emerges in this trinational region. And there's so much to be learned from going deep into those stories, which the museum is very much about. And at the same time, it's not just our story. It's every story. It's every story along the border. It's every story in every community. It just gets played out in different ways. But there are these universal themes, right, about what it means to be human, about how we deal with conflict, about how we all strive for belonging, that get kind of are the umbrella. And, you know, I think we want people, when they leave the Museum of Us, to sort of leave feeling that maybe their assumptions have been challenged, their worldview has been stretched, they've been asked to sort of bend, if not, but not break, and it's allowed them to go back out into the world with a little bit of a fresh perspective, a little bit changed than when they left. And that when they hear the news, they participate in discussions around the dinner table or at the book club or at work, that those conversations are a little bit more hopeful about, you know, the beauty of what it means to be a human, the unique genius that we all have, and that we need spaces such as the museum and others where people can tap into that unique genius and bring their gifts to bear on the world in ways that help lift us all.
Absolutely love that answer. That is a perfect place to wrap up. Micah Parzon, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Grant. Thanks so much. Always enjoy speaking with you.
Likewise.
So Micah just gave me so much to think about, and I'm just blown away just by the history of Balboa Park.
Right. Yeah, Crystal, that was an important conversation, an amazing conversation on so many different levels, because there is history in this community, as in any community, that sometimes we want to forget because it's complicated and it's messy. And there are people who have been working on helping us own it in a productive way that actually benefits everybody who's here now. And I just love the spirit in which Micah approaches this very complicated question. I'm wondering, you know, for you, what stood out as the most important comment or piece that he dealt with?
So right after, because we're recording this later, I'm just going to acknowledge that, but right after Micah came in and you interviewed him, I went back to the Museum of Us. And what really stood out to me was their choice to build a relationship with the Kumeyaay tribe, knowing it was going to take time. And then now that they know better, they did better with the museum. And so him talking us through the process and the conversation that you two just had, it's like that's how we do better in the world. You know, it's the coming together and taking the time to build a relationship of trust, you know, and it's the same thing we're trying to do at Prebis right now.
So. Yeah. Well, and I was struck by the how much he and the museum are wrestling with the fact that we have complicated histories and that they're not neat and simple. You can't just make it about good guys and bad guys, or people who did right things and wrong things. Although you certainly can do an element of that. You know, I think the story of the indigenous community that was moved off of the park because they didn't look quote unquote indigenous enough is just mind boggling. You know, so to dispossess people of their land because they couldn't play the part that they actually were in the judgment of the community that was in charge then is mind-boggling. But, you know, then you go deeper into the whole narrative of the park, the name of the park, the conquistador statue right outside the museum. And, yeah, it becomes then heritages begin to collide, right? And then so there are stories that begin to bump up against each other. And I think what the Museum of Us is trying to do and Micah is trying to do is figure out how you tell those stories fairly and create room for people to feel represented in those stories.
The whole thing, the entire time you all were talking, it was just shocking to me to we're going to swap out these folks for these folks, even though they're the people who live here. So there's like the initial shock, and then it's like, how do we improve upon this, right? Like I grew up in North County, Grant, so we would, St. Francis Elementary School, we'd take our little bus down to the museum, and you're like, okay, these are the Indians of San Diego in the 90s or the 1915 moment, and that's what you learn. And so now as an adult walking back through that museum, I see things have been updated or we don't do this kind of exhibit anymore. And you're right. There's this cyclical nature of improving history. We gather more facts. We adjust. We acknowledge that it's going to be imperfect. But when we bring more people to the table, it gets better. So I just admire his courage, but also that he's willing to share that story. They're not trying to hide it. They're saying, hey, you know, we're going to improve and get better. And this is going to be good for everybody in San Diego.
And a great example of that was the discussion that we had about the border wall panels. And the, you know, the truth is that there was art on those panels. You know, the border wall between the Mexican and U.S. side of Friendship Park on the Mexican side was heavily decorated with murals. And there's a whole narrative that exists in those panels about the meaning of the park, the meaning of family, the way in which cultures celebrate family and togetherness or separation and division. And in each in their own artistic way, those panels tell that story. I am so impressed that the museum had the courage to go to the, I mean, I want people to imagine this for a moment. In the present politics, somebody comes to you, in this case, John Fanestel and the Friends of Friendship Park, come to the museum and say, we'd like to save these panels. Could that be done? And if you're Micah, you then process that, and in this environment you say, yeah, let's go ask the federal government if we can have these border wall panels. And you can imagine 1,000 ways in which the verdict would have come down no. And then as once he got permission there, he had to go to the contractors who were in charge of this, who could have, for all kinds of reasons, decided that they didn't want to play. And he stuck at it, and he worked at it diplomatically and quietly, and came away preserving a piece of history that now will help our region tell the story of this very important place and this very important border and this singular moment in history. I think it's extraordinary. I think it's hard. And I have a lot of admiration for their willingness to do it. I think what will be interesting next is, what does San Diego do with it? You know, that's actually the next part of that project, as he talked about, is letting community decide what these panels actually mean.
Right. Well, and I guess I'm curious, because the part that you just skipped over is that Micah came to you at some point and said, hey, Will Prebis, I think it was that way, Will Prebis, mm-hmm. work with us to make this happen. So Micah shows up at your door or calls you. And what was your reaction, or why did you say yes on this project?
That did happen. And so he just mentioned to me that he wanted to do this, but that in order to make it happen, they needed obviously resources. And on the spot, I decided that it made sense for the foundation to support this, because we care about art and we care about culture and we care about the celebrating the part of our heritage that is about the border and the coming together of peoples here. We just think it's such an extraordinary defining element of San Diego. And so it made sense in the moment to say yes. And fortunately, our board supported that as well. But I think what made that easy is that in this work, we learn a couple of things very quickly. One is that leadership matters. So if you have a leader like Micah is, who is bold and visionary and willing to really work hard on behalf of what it is they're trying to make happen, you want to get behind that. And the second is, again, that if you say you care about something, then you actually have to model that in the moment. And we care about what this project represents. So that was a relatively easy call.
Well, and I noticed in what you just said, but also what Micah and John Fanastilla, Friends of Friendship Park, have said, is like, these are for the community. You asked me before, like, what does San Diego do with them? And I've noticed with all three of you, you're not saying we have the plan for what we're doing. It's, you know, what do we do next with it? And so I'm curious, have you heard in those conversations or what do you think San Diegans may want to do with them? Is that conversation already happening?
Well, I think that conversation is what the museum and Friends of Friendship Park will be undertaking next. And I think they want to do it in multiple communities, in multiple ways, with many, many different audiences and in many different venues. And I hope that they will be successful in that. I mean, I think they're setting themselves a hard task, because there are probably a million opinions and feelings about those panels. But in a way, that's the beauty of the project. The project is a true art project in that it's not just about the object, the thing. It is about what it's evoking in people. And I think to understand that is... well, it's another indication of why the Museum of Us is doing important work, because they're willing to view the work through that lens. It's again, it's not just about an object, but about what it means and what it evokes and how people relate to it and what they wish for it. I think that's such a great way of hopefully approaching all the work that our leaders do.
Yeah, I think I really hope when people listen to your interview with Micah that it makes us all stop and reflect, right? One of the things I will say I will miss about prior to my arrival on the podcast, Grant, is I think you're so meditative and reflecting on things. And I think in the work of someone like Micah and the artistry of what he's doing, is it really is like we all have to stop and talk, but then listen and reflect on it, right? Yeah. And I think, to your point, now we have these great art panels, which we will post on the website so folks can see But then it's like, let's think about what is the use in the community? What does it communicate? Mm. And if you look at old photos, some of those murals are just filled with love and connection of people separated by a border, you know?
Yeah. And in some ways, we'll never know the stories behind those panels. But I think, you know, this is maybe a good place to end, or at least something to touch on before we end, is, you know, the Museum of Us is in Balboa Park, and Balboa Park, yes, as we were talking about earlier, has a complicated history, but it is an extraordinary cultural place in the United States of America. Within that park and its cultural district, there is a set of museums and cultural resources that is, I think, the envy of everywhere. Some exceptional work is being done there. And the park itself represents a collective community yearning for places to come together, for places to dream, for places to wonder, for places to engage in awe, and places to reflect. And sometimes all of that can be challenging and hard, even depressing. We may have to grieve. Other times it is celebratory and joyous and lifts us up out of whatever places we're stuck in. And so I think what I would say about this whole conversation with Micah is what I would say about the park itself, which is we have this amazing place, and we have these amazing and powerful leaders among us trying to preserve those places and make them better. And we should all want to be a part of that in the same way that we're going to be a part of the panel project.
Here, here. I think that's the final thought.
All right. There we go. This is a production of the Prebys Foundation, hosted by Grant Oliphant and co-hosted by Crystal Page. The program is co-produced by Crystal Page and Adam Greenfield, and it's engineered by Adam Greenfield. Production assistance is provided by Tess Kresge. And our new theme song is by Mr. Lyrical Groove, a local San Diego artist. Download episodes at your favorite podcatcher or visit us at stopandtalkpodcast.org. If you like this show, and we really hope you do, the best way to support it is to share, subscribe, and review our podcast. Thank you for your support, your ideas, and most of all, for listening. This program has been recorded at the Voice of San Diego podcast studio.